Yes, so I'm actually going to say something a little bit different than the official title. If you'll excuse me. Is there a pointer? Fine. Okay. Okay, so I want to talk about some work that's been done in my group over the last few years on modeling transcription, and it's mostly the work of Margaritis Voliotis, who was formerly a student, who's now a Brunel Fellow in Bristol, and two former colleagues in Leeds. And these are the people who funded it. And so I want to start off talking about transcription. So most of what we've heard about the last day or so has been about structure in the nucleus or structure of DNA. And what I want to talk about now is dynamics. So so it's a bit of a change of track. But of course, we know that life is dynamic. So in some sense, maybe it's not totally pointless to do that. So we'll do that. So I want to talk about essentially transcription and really talk about the dynamics of transcription at a sort of mesoscopic level, talk about various details of how this happens, relate to some single molecule experiments, talk about how maybe one can put that into some model of transcription and make some predictions about RNA population dynamics. And then finally, I want to say something about a model for proofreading and transcription. So we know that, we all know this, so I don't need to say this, but essentially, it's interesting not only to know the structure, but also to know the dynamics. And the dynamics essentially is encoded in this this expression level of the cell, the phenotype, which essentially determines what the cell is doing. Okay, i.e. the difference between your eye cell or your skin cell. And the point is that even within cells of the same phenotype, there will be variations in the levels of the genes. So, and essentially, it's something that's often ignored. One thinks basically about some bulk population of RNA or protein, and you think about it as some continuous process, but really it's highly irregular with periods of activity and inactivity, and these differences are very important, leading to things like differentiation, disease, and such things. So understanding this irregularity is kind of important. Mm-hmm. And how do we characterize this irregularity? Well, we want to look at variability. So we want to somehow say, what's the variability between one cell and the other? So this is a picture I like very much. I mean, so these are the fingerprints of two twins. This is the first cloned cat. Okay, so here you see the original. This was done in Texas A&M, and it was funded by this company, which is called Genetic Savings and Clones Incorporated. It's a company which essentially proposes to make a copy of your dear pet when they pass away. So effectively, when Dido passes away, you take his gene to these guys and they make you a copy. And apparently they were thinking of charging about $100,000. This was before the recession. So basically, they've gone bust. But thankfully, they actually funded some research, which was useful. So anyway, so they funded this research, and this was the first cloned cat. What you see is that this is a clone, okay? But it's totally different. Huh? It's got a different fur pattern. Apparently, the clone looks a bit fatter, So they're obviously different. So I guess whichever owner would be kind of disappointed in their product. So it's not quite the copy that you thought you'd get. Sorry?
They just bought it in the market.
Okay. So it's a no-brainer. I mean, the fluctuations happen. They are kind of they're kind of there. So what makes it interesting to focus on fluctuations is now that you have tools which can really probe them. Because you can imagine there's lots of sources of that. You have environment is fluctuating, so you know why, of course, twins aren't the same. Even in the womb, they aren't in the same position. We have lots of variabilities of the cells to the cell. We have mutations. We have small numbers of molecules. So there's all these sources of fluctuations. And there's also the fact of the nature of even the way things are produced gives us fluctuations. So it seems really quite difficult to make any progress there. However, with kind of, if you want, reporter, fluorescence reporters, you can actually start maybe teasing out some of these differences. Because imagine, look at this experiment here. So here, what you have are just two genes, which are stimulated by the same promoter. So one on either side of the promoter. So essentially, if one gene is, if the promoter is on, that means both genes are switched on at the same time. So, well, if all things being equal, that means that you, one gene is green, one is red, so everything should be yellow, because basically they all switch on at the same time. However, you don't find everything yellow. You find some cells are green, some are red. That means that some cells are producing more of one than the other, and this is from this you can tell that there are fluctuations in this expression level. And in this case, all these things are the same. You would assume so. Therefore, you're really looking really at the dynamics of the production of the gene, the transcription and translation. So kind of how do you model fluctuations? So well, typically one does, right, uses some master equation to solve them. And essentially you have some sort of discrete reactants and you have some probabilistic chemical reactions and you model them as some birth-death process. And the key fact is that if you then make a population with such a dynamics, you find that the ratio of the variance to the mean is one. So you essentially get a Poisson distribution. However, I mean, this is true for some experiments that you do find that this distribution is one. But actually, there are several experiments, growing experiments, where, for example, you find that these expression levels are not Poissonian. They fluctuate more than you'd expect from such a process. And so, I guess one of the things that motivates us is asking, could we understand what this is? Maybe by looking a bit closer at what's happening in transcription. And of course, transcription is actually not a simple birth-death process. It's actually a complicated process, of course, and we kind of know about it. I mean, this is just the argument why, of course, you expect Poisson statistics, because you've got birth-death processes and gives you statistics which is Poissonian. The only thing is I should say is that, of course, remember, this is a genetic network, so these things all depend on everything else. This is really complicated. But nevertheless, this is the framework in which, if you want, you generally study these systems. So let's look at transcription. So in a bit more detail. So what's happening? Okay. Well, I want to start this. This is supposed to be a video, but the video is misbehaving. So well, this was going to be a nice video showing polymerase moving along. Along the DNA. So how does the transcription happen? Well, we have RNA polymerase, which is a NTP-driven motor, which binds onto the DNA at the promoter site with the help of some accessory proteins. This process is called initiation. Once it's bound to the DNA, then it forms. This process of initiation involves the formation of a transcription bubble. So the DNA essentially double strands are separated, and this machinery forms a stable complex with this bubble and then starts transcribing. As it transcribes, it makes a complementary RNA strand to the DNA. And of interest is to note that this process of transcription doesn't necessarily happen only in one direction, because as it sort of goes along with this bubble, it is possible that, of course, that the this thing can slide back. Okay, so it's going along, adding nucleotides one at a time, but if if for some reason it closed the back of the bubble and closed the front of the bubble and opened the back, this polymerase would move back in register, and you would get a sort of a trailing edge of RNA, and this thing could, in principle, move back. And this thing has been noted and is well accepted. And this again, as we've just seen in the previous talk, beautiful single molecule experiments can actually study this dynamics. And I guess the first experiments were done in the Bloch lab, but several other labs have produced it. So you can attach a bead to a piece of DNA and a polymerase, and you can watch the polymerase as it runs along the DNA. And what these experiments show is that actually this polymerase running along the DNA is not just a smooth one-dimensional process. It's a process which is actually very stochastic. It seems to spend quite a lot of time backtracking. It stops, and goes back. And of course, in order for it to do that, it must close the bubble at the front and open it at the back. So it's got to do that and leave a sort of trailing edge of RNA in the front. Okay, so imagine, so this is what we're thinking here. So you're going along here, then you stop, you start going back. If you go back, then you're going to have sort of a trailing edge of RNA in the front. And it's also known that RNA, this polymerase is something, it's a nuclease, so it has this possibility to cleave RNA. And so it has been, if you want, hinted at that maybe this might have something to do with proofreading. And I hope to say something after towards the end of the talk. Anyway, what they observed in this paper was that there was lots of pauses, and they classified them in a rather ad hoc way by grouping them into short and long pauses, and said that the long pauses had an exponential distribution. Okay, so of course, so this is the kind of thing you want to know. It's kind of too hard for most people, so let's just look at some smaller things. So kind of like, I guess we want to, so we try to understand something about this origin of these fluctuations starting from some model of transcription. We kind of have a reasonable model of transcription based on biochemistry and single molecule experiments. And we want to try to do something which is maybe a little bit crazy and try to link the single molecule behavior to expression levels at the cellular level. Okay. And so to do that, we need to have some model of transcription. And I said this is kind of a well accepted biochemical picture of what's going on. So as I said, we have this bubble, which is formed. We can specify the position of the nucleotide, of the last transcribed nucleotide, as N, right? How far we've got. It goes, big N is the length of the gene, if we want. And then, and the way it works is, we said it has this process of translocation and polymerization. So it polymerizes and translocates and translocates. How am I doing? Yeah, good joke. Yeah, good. Okay, good, fine. So essentially this bubble forms, and as we said, it can also it translocates and at the same time polymerizes. We can essentially talk about it after polymerization. We can say it's in a pre-translocated state. Then it translocates. Then it polymerizes. So we have this dynamics of transient polymerization, and of course it can go into this backtrack. Obviously now I have to speed up. So I've been told. This thing, and so we can. If we want to think of this process, this is in some sense some kind of schematic of the process. So we have essentially we're going along here, but at every translocating and polymerizing. But every point, of course, we can go along the backtrack. We don't backtrack all the way to the beginning because, well, actually, we the RNA once it's formed forms hairpins. So actually. There will be some repulsion of the RNA to the polymerase, so it'll, in some sense, it will come back. So we essentially have to solve this problem of this transcription. We have a first passage problem. We've got to go through this complicated dynamics and get to the end and calculate, essentially, hopefully calculate the dynamics of this process. Okay. So first thing is, let's ignore the backtracking. Let's assume the backtracking is negligible and just look at the dynamics. Well, in that case, what we have essentially is just some biased random walk. The polymerization rate is about 100 times bigger than the depolymerization rate, so essentially it just goes down and it makes things at a... It just makes the RNA at a very constant rate. So we get a very well-defined mean elongation time. Variance is very small, and essentially what happens is the fluctuations are going to be much smaller than exponential. So the mRNA population would be sub-Poissonian. There'll be very few fluctuations because essentially you're making things at a very constant rate. So therefore, ignoring the backtracks doesn't work. So we need to include the backtracks. So what happens? This thing pauses when it enters this backtrack state. Once it enters the backtrack state, it's going to hop with some rate. And because of hairpins, it can only backtrack a certain distance. Eventually, it'll hit the hairpin, and then it will stop. And then, essentially what we have is some hopping random motion with reflecting binding conditions. And we can calculate, for example, the distribution of pauses. So this is something that's very easy to do. So we just have essentially this diffusion with reflecting binding conditions at the end, and we can calculate the first passage time it takes, and we can obtain an expression. And I mean, essentially the main. So well, this is sort of if you want. There's a little bit of nice mathematics. You use Laplace transform methods and you can express things in terms of feeder functions, but in any case, the behavior can be characterized essentially in two regimes. For times short compared to the time it takes for the thing to diffuse to this, barrier given by the hairpins, it's basically showing the first passage time of one-dimensional diffusion process. For times long compared to this typical time, then this is cut off because, of course, it hits the barrier and then has to come back. So essentially, it's something like a power law, which then gets cut off by the barrier at the other end. And so this is kind of, if you want, consistent with this Heaviton distribution observed by Heaviton et al. And then there's more recent experiments, which on RNAP2, which is, again, a different enzyme, which show this minus 3/2 behavior. It is not, it's only one decade, so I'm not going to say that. Okay, so now we've understood the backtracks. They seem reasonable. So now we can now put the whole thing together into a model for the transcription. So it's sort of messy. Let's just turn it into a bunch of simple quantities that we can understand. The important thing to understand is the number of pauses over a typical template of length n. So essentially, and the point is, the thing that's important is the sum of the lifetime of the pauses compared to the time spent on active polymerization. So if the time spent on polymerization is much longer than the time spent on pauses, then essentially pauses are negligible. And we go back to the thing we did before when we ignore them. However, if the time spent on polymerization multiplied by the number of pauses divided by the time is long, then the pauses will dominate the elongation time. And of course, this number is just given by the rate of entering these backtracks. So we can obtain it from the rate of entering backtracks compared to the polymerization rate. We believe so. So essentially, when translocation is not the rate limiting step, then if polymerization is favored, then we can define this ratio, which is just ratio of those two things. And if R is bigger than one, the poses dominate. If R is less than one, the poses are negligible, and you have something in between. Okay, but okay, so that was fine. So, but that's just telling us about the poses. But actually, in order to understand what's going on, we need to actually put everything together. So what we really have is an initiation process. We have this process of going along with the pauses. We have termination, we have degradation. Now, this is an image of a piece of DNA and with RNA polymerases along it. So could people tell me why this is the beginning and that is the end of the gene? What's short and what's long? What is short about the beginning? The RNA. Yeah. Yes. The RNA are short. So we can tell that here we're transcribing full RNAs and here we're not. I think that I want to point out here is that there's lots of polymerases here. Okay, so it's possible to have many initiative processes can occur in the time to produce a single RNA. So therefore, you have multiple applications of the template by the things moving in tandem. Each of them. And now, of course, polymerases can't get too close because they've additional work to deform the DNA helix. So essentially what we have is essentially some, if you want a model, where the polymerases can form traffic jams. So there's some maximum distance between them. If one of these things stops, then the ones behind it, of course, cannot move anymore, so they're blocked. And again, okay, one can solve this, and you can solve this numerically using Monte Carlo simulations. But essentially, again, we can identify a bunch of different timescales. So first timescale is a timescale for initiation. This is the time it takes for things to start. Other timescale is the timescale needed to transcribe certain nucleotides, which is just the length divided by the polymerization rate. This length here, we said, is the maximum extreme distance between them, which is about 80 base pairs, and the typical mean time of a pause. Okay, so now we can now put it all together, and depending on these ratio of time scales, then get very different behavior. So the initiation is a rate limiting step, so that means that the longest time is the time it takes for the RNA polymerase to bind on the template. Then the distribution is approximately Poissonian. Polymerization is the rate limiting step, which is basically the regime we said the model A. Then essentially all it just things just polymerize, run through. This is sub Poissonian. And if the long pauses dominate the transcription, then we get a super Poissonian behavior, and the variance is much bigger than the mean. And we get burst of this RNA production due to these stopped polymerase is acting as congestion points. And the system switches between states of high and low RNA production. And I'm just going to go quickly. So, going back to the experiments I talked about at the beginning, these experiments measured mRNA populations and using very sophisticated fluorescence, which and measured this ratio of these variances in mean, and it's 4.1, so the fluctuations are much bigger than Poissonian, and they found the switching time between the off and on states of this sort of time. So essentially, this is a thing where cells, you see bursts of transcription with that sort of typical switching times between them. And now we can put in the sort of numbers that we have from the what we understand about the single molecule behavior. So we have the polymerization rates, we have the depolymerization rates, we have the degradation rates, we have the rates of entering backtracking states, the backtracking diffusion time, and the initiation rate, and we find that this system, with these numbers, will go through this bursting with a switching time of the order of on time of a minute and off times of 10 minutes. So in some sense, so this bursting dynamics is consistent with this picture of these paused RNA polymerases having, if you want, traffic jams. But of course, this is something I expect everybody to say, but what about the transcription factor binding? I could also have switching because of transcription factor binding, because actually, if the transcription factors were bound on, that would give me a switching behavior. And at this point, I would say that's true. However, if one looks at the distribution of the population of RNAs that you obtain from this, it's very different to the distribution that you obtain from this traffic jam model. So again, the way to discriminate between these two pictures, if you wish, will be to look at more sophisticated analysis of the population dynamics of the RNAs. Yeah. Yes. On average. Yes. But it goes through essentially periods when you're producing a lot, then periods when nothing is happening. So what you're talking about is average. When you average over, pauses, exactly, yes. Singer, yes, exactly. So, yes.
So, in this bursting phase, do we observe the time of prescription is much longer than when we have the bursting phase?
Okay, well, first thing is that typically it seems that you tend to find that certain genes show bursting and other genes don't. So the genes which tend not to show, the genes which need to be produced a lot, the housekeeping genes, don't show bursting. They seem to show much more smooth behavior. It tends to be those which are associated with certain points of the cell cycle. It's those ones which seem to show this kind of bursting behavior. And so therefore, these ones, of course, are there, usually at lower numbers. And
if you measure the rate of transcription for these two different genes, Do you see a big difference in the rate of the polymerase RNA? Because it's the same RNA pore that transcribes in both cases.
Yes.
If in one case it spends most of its time pausing and in the other case it's more continuous, I would expect to see a big difference in the average rate of transcription of the RNA pore in those two genes.
Well, typically, I think that's usually the case. As I said, I think the genes which tend to not show pausing are those which are generally produce a lot, and so therefore the rates of production are higher in general. So so it tends to be the non-housekeeping genes, the genes which are that show this type of behavior.
Please go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now, how am I going for time?
Now, really, you have 2 minutes.
Okay, so essentially, So let's look back at this backtracking and ask why do we see this backtracking? Does it have any biological function? And of course, we all know that there's kinetic proofreading, which says that there must be some active mechanism of error correction. Because if we just take putting the numbers for the delta G for forming wrong or correct nucleotides, we have exponent error of 10 to the minus 3, whereas the error fraction is of the order of 10 to the minus 5. So how do we get this difference? Well, we need to have some active process to do this. We see that the error fraction should be e to the minus delta g, where delta g is the difference in energy. If delta g is 4 to 7 kt, that gives us a factor of about 500. So what happens? And then, of course, Hopfield says that you require a branching process. Hopfield and Nino say you require a branching process. And with this branching process, then the ratio of the rates for the correct to the wrong will give you an additional factor. And if you have more branches, you can have more this thing. So this backtracking then actually looks like an interesting mechanism for this process, essentially because this mRNA also has this exonucleus activity. So essentially, this is the kind of model. We have elongated RNA P. It's polymerizing, fixed error. It backtracks. When it backtracks, it can cleave and correct error. And we know that the cleavage sites are act on the RNA polymerase, so act on the RNA. And so we get this renormalized error fraction, which ratio of wrong to this. So essentially, we take our backtracking model, take into account the fact that the rates get changed by the presence of the error. Unfortunately, so the presence of the error is going to change your delta g, but it's also going to, it can also change the barriers. So in some sense, there's a whole range of possible models which one could think of, which possibly can give rise to difference in these rates, and then you have the cleavage which happens when the thing goes back. So putting this all together, we obtain an error fraction which scales with the distance this thing goes back. And the presence of the error then leads to this, and the presence of the error then can then lead to the renormalization of this error by a factor which depends on m. So essentially, the boundary m gives you m chances to correct the error. Okay, let's just finish, and then again we can put in the numbers. So essentially, these are the conclusions, because I'm running out of time, and there are various perspectives. Elongation, we did elongation of force. Force becomes this becomes very force dependent, as you can imagine. We haven't included transcriptional arrest, sequence dependence, translation, and the effects of Bayesian dynamics and gene expression. So thank you very much for your time.
Before we proceed to clever questions, could you go back to your equation with time dependence, which was basic equation in the very beginning? There was a slide there.
Okay.
It was a model where you showed exponential dependence, power law, and things like that. And I'm just soliciting. Okay. Okay.
You mean this?
Yes, this.
Yeah.
Just wait a second, I'll just finish with that. Because see, you show us, this is a general form, yeah?
Yeah.
And you have a power law here, and here there is no time here.
No, there's...
Where is time?
Okay.
IT here.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you deduce that limiting case for long time.
Yeah. And so it's just a matter of you reorganize a series. Okay. It's an asymptotic series, which is valid for T.
Yes, please.
Tommy, when you were presenting your traffic model, including the backtracking, I was wondering whether there is any similarity between motor proteins like myosin and actin. If you have myosin and actin moving both ways, and if it gets very dense, you get a cooperative phase where they either move collectively right or collectively left.
Yes.
Shown by Prost and
so on.
Why doesn't that not show up in your model?
Okay, there are two ways you could say that. One way is you could say actually this bursting behavior, I didn't show this slide, is a cooperative behavior. It is essentially, you have periods when essentially everything is moving, and then everything is not. So in some sense, what you're seeing is a collective phenomenon of the whole population. So what you find either all of them are going or
not. But it's not periodic.
Okay, I haven't finished yet.
Okay.
Okay, so the next step is then you could also have a coupling to force. So, and so I think there, so if, for example, then you find that actually when they get close, they start deforming the helix, and then you get a coupling which will be dependent on this tension in DNA, then you'll get an additional coupling, which will then probably even make it stronger. So then, okay, so, okay.
I quite agree, yeah.
Okay.
Can you help with me? Thank you.
Thank you.
So you said you could distinguish between the congestion model and the transcription factor unbinding model based on a distribution and number of mRNAs. So I'm wondering, what's the what is the distribution predicted from the congestion model?
Well, I mean, we don't have an analytic. We have numerics. I mean, it's a fact. I mean, I guess I can show you some schematic plots. I mean, I can show you later on if you want plots. But it's essentially a broad distribution, which is broad. I mean, so this is, if you want the distribution for the okay, so three, this one. The blue one is the Poisson distribution. Okay, and the red one is the distribution that's generated by the model.
Yes. No, just. Okay. Yeah. From Dorothy Eriot UNC and some other people, there are additional internal states to the RNA polymerase, like the hypertranslocated states and so on, and the kinetic rates and so on are quite different as you hop between these internal states. And I think there's allosteric control of these states by nucleotides in solution and so on. So how do you think all these things? Do you think all these things are relevant in vivo, and whether your model that doesn't include them, like, is it where would you go with that? Because it is quite complicated. The full diagrams are
Of course, yes. So, yeah. It's a good question. I mean, so effectively speaking, we have grossly simplified the model of transcription by simplifying it to essentially a relatively small number of states. So I guess the argument that you can use for this kind of thing is Occam's razor. You say that when you choose the simplest model which you think can describe your data. Furthermore, you could also say that these internal states will in some way give you some renormalized parameters for a model like this. The problem is that these rates might change depending on the state of the system.
But it could, yeah, that's what I was going to say, is that it could dramatically change the stochastic, because if you have non-Poissonian distributions within these internal states, then the outcome can be dramatically different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One of your main points was fluctuations, that you're trying to describe fluctuation. As soon as you have additional states, fluctuations will be huge. This is known for motor proteins, something that call about randomness. Mm-hmm. As soon as you have more steps, will be randomness. So, and your statement at the beginning for chemical master equation that it's one is correct if it's only one state. The presence of state, chemical state that Garrick mentioned, immediately wash away all of this problem with Poissonian or non-Poissonian. So it might be a problem if you talk about fluctuations.
Okay, so so I guess the issue here now is what one wants to do if one wants to describe, let's say, such a complicated system. Now, clearly, you could put in much more detail, and we can get a very complicated model. So, I mean, and in some sense, what we've done here is combined a bunch of exponential, processes.
I think the answer is clear,
yes.
Right? Okay,
yeah.
There are different positions,
yeah.
But the answer is clear.
Yeah.
But one thing, if we take your model as it is, without, that type of criticism, where is your coupling and feedback between, for instance, error and stepping back?
Where
in equations it actually sits? Could you clarify?
Okay. So,
because we want to understand, every model creates some world.
Okay.
We want to understand how it's created.
So, I guess
it doesn't matter whether it's realistic or not.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the point here is, if you have an error, then you get some shift in your energy landscape. Now, you can shift this landscape in two ways. You can imagine. I mean, so again, this is a problem.
Simply probability of stepping back in green. Yes. In that case. Yes. Okay, that's it. Thank you. Further questions, please. Oh, okay. So people are happy. Thank you very much, Tony. It's a complicated issue. Don't take this criticism personally because it's a complicated issue. We have an announcement to make because the second session will be have two parts. Will be one lecture of Vologodsky, and then there will be a poster session. And Shura is going to make some announcement about the poster session. And
so there will be two poster sessions. One, the last session in the morning, and one, the last session in the afternoon. We have right now 24 submitted posters. They are ordered in alphabetic order, following the first, the last name of the first author. So alphabetic order. Therefore, if your name begins with B, then you are surely speaking in the morning. If your name starts with Z, then you are surely in the afternoon. If you are M or N or L, then see me and for exact count.
Anyway, yeah, it's a very vague state, not like many things in biology, right? I will try to digest 12 presentations in my session. And that means essentially everyone gets 4 minutes. And it means 1 minute area, 2 minutes what you actually have done, and 1 minute what to write home about. If there is nothing to write home about, better just relax.
And 3 minutes is even better.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good. Let's enjoy coffee break.
Don't get me wrong, you did right.